Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current edition of my sermon for this Sunday. We are awash in conspiracy theories. I don't know if many of you have noticed that. You can find it on social media. Conspiracy theories are very interesting things. COVID-19 has thrown gasoline on the fire of conspiracy theorists. The elite want to cull the population of white men, old people, people of certain ethnicities or countries. Someone's behind this virus, and it's happening. And it's usually a group we're worried about. 5G cell towers have caused this. That was an early conspiracy theory in France, which led some people in the UK to start torching cell towers. Quite a bit more recently, a lot of vaccination conspiracy ideas floating around. How much money does Anthony Fauci make from patents on viruses? I don't know. On vaccines? I don't know. What will these vaccines be safe and effective? They haven't been very successful in making vaccines about coronaviruses. I don't know. This is for herd control. A lot of people out there saying vaccines are the mark of the beast. Lots of ideas going around. Now, we should be a little fair with conspiracy theories. Sometimes they turn out to be true. And I found Reader's Digest Australia had a list of 12 of them, some of which are here. The U.S. government stole body parts of deceased children during the Cold War in the 50s to test radiation on young flesh. Wow. True. U.S. government experimented with LSD on unwitting people. True. U.S. government poisoned alcohol during Prohibition to discourage drinking, and something like 10,000 people died of this. True. Cigarette companies knew there was a link between smoking and cancer in the 50s. True. The Gulf of Tonkin incident to get the U.S. into the Vietnam War. Was that a contrivance because the American government wanted to sway the American people? Wasn't the first time. Woodrow Wilson's wife made decisions for him when he was incapacitated with a stroke. She was, in a sense, the first woman president of the United States. True. The Dalai Lama was a CIA spy, and on the CIA payroll. It's true. And I put the link down below. But is every conspiracy theory true? No. Which ones are true? How do you know the truth? In fact, knowing the truth is really, really hard. Well, why? Well, because the world is really, really big and we are really, really small. And even an idea of the truth is a very complex idea with all kinds of connections. And this isn't hard to figure out. Just think about things that your grandparents believed and you don't. Living in the same world, usually about beliefs about the same kinds of things, moral beliefs, historical beliefs, scientific beliefs, beliefs about marriage and child rearing, changed dramatically in 100 years. What makes us think 100 years from now they won't look at us like we look at people 100 years ago? How much evidence do you really have? And is that really how you make your decisions? And what are the sources? You see, we're not even sure, and this is a crazy thing, we're not even sure about what a human being should eat. Now, all of us have been human beings for our entire lives, and all of us have been eating for our entire lives, but just look at the dramatic debates on what to feed a human being. All things in moderation, or the paleo diet, or the vegan diet, or the carnivore diet. Well, we follow the data. That's been the cry of the leadership of the government during the pandemic. Which data? Conspiracy theorists are just looking at different data. And if you pull up a video that gets quickly taken down from Facebook or YouTube, they've got data. Who can you trust? How do you know? Why does the question of who you can trust impact what you know? Well, one of the people in my video world I've been in conversation with is a cognitive scientist from the University of Toronto named John Vervaeke, and he has a big series on awakening from the meaning crisis. And in episode 27, he goes through something that I found very interesting and has really stuck with me, the idea of problem formation. What exactly is a problem, and how do we address them in our lives? And he talks about all of this research that they've done on problems, that there's an initial state and a goal state, and there are near infinite ways to get from the initial state to the goal state, but there are lots of constraints that make it far more complicated. For example, if I know that chlorine bleach can kill the virus on a counter, or better yet, alcohol can kill the virus on a counter, can I kill the virus in my body by drinking vodka? Is, you know, should we just put everybody in the hospital on screwdrivers? Well, no, body doesn't work that way. So, what happens in reality is what Vervaeke calls combinatorial explosion, that the number of potential solutions, the number of potential reasons behind things, we can apply this to conspiracy theories, reasons behind things just grows exponentially. And the difficulty that we have as human beings who are small and can only know so many things and only live in a particular place at a particular time and have only so much time to act and decide and to do is that we have to greatly narrow the field of possible options down into just a few options. And the way we limit the options is actually herds. We go together as groups. And that's why the question of, well, what's happening? What's true about the coronavirus and this pandemic or plandemic or whatever? What's true about this has a lot to do with the decisions about who we decide to trust and who we decide to follow. Now, sheep is the most common biblical image for how we are and how we behave. The Lord is my shepherd. Psalm 23, there is safety in, and this is a herding up is a very legitimate way for vulnerable creatures to stay safe. Fish do it in school. Sheep do it in herds because we watch to see who gets eaten because we don't want it to be us. And two heads are better than one. And together, maybe we'll figure out something that all alone we couldn't figure out. So herds have trust and variability as error connection, as error correction. But yet just following the herd is problematic too. And so we're always weighing these two dynamics one against the other. Now you might wonder, what kind of a sermon is this? Well, I've been following during these seasons, we're in the season of Easter, I've been following the lectionary, which is kind of a herd thing for preachers, where we go through a certain list of texts, sort of all together, and Sunday school materials are geared towards it, and it's sort of a way for the church to sort of herd up and to gain a balanced diet, and to give our ancestors sort of a seat at the table. And so I usually do it during certain liturgical times of the year and not during others. And so we're kind of doing that because we're going through 2 Peter, we're going through 1 Peter, and we're going through the lectionary. And last week we looked at all of chapter 2, and the lectionary says this week we're only going to look at a few verses. And we're not going to get to the whole rest of the book of Peter, so that'll explain the conspiracy in my mind behind the formation of some of the rest of this sermon. Now, the first text, what you'll notice what the lectionary gives you is a group of texts. And the group of texts are designed to sort of all come together into a coherent message. Now, usually I just pick one of the texts for the sermon, and Pete sometimes uses the psalm from the lectionary as part of the liturgy, and this is what we do. But because I'm taking such a different way through the book of 1 Peter, I think it's helpful to look at the rest of the passages, particularly the passage from Acts. The passage from Acts is the stoning of Stephen, where Stephen, full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God, and Jesus standing at the right hand of God, and said, "Behold, I see the heavens open, and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." But they cried out in a loud voice, the people who Now, there's a lot behind this that I've talked about and maybe talk about when we get to Pentecost, that a lot of the conflict going on in Jerusalem at this time, they're trying to sort out what to think about this Jesus fellow who got crucified, and his disciples are claiming he rose from the dead, and there's a very hot culture war going on in Judea over the Roman occupation, and many of the actors in this particular story are Jews who were born out in the diaspora. Stephen is one of them, and Saul is one of them. This is different from Peter, who's, you know, from the Holy Land, as we call it, who's from the Galilee and Judea. And so the conflict surrounding Jesus and the temple gets really hot at this point. And Stephen, who was named as one of the deacons to take care of the Greek-speaking widows, and who has a Greek name, Stephen finds himself in the middle of it and basically is about to get killed, stoned, in the traditional way that you stone blasphemers, and they're calling this Jesus the Son of Man. So they cried out in a loud voice and stopped their ears and rushed together at him. Then they cast him out of the city and stoned him. And now, actually, if you think about it, there's a lot of controversy around why did Jesus get crucified? Because what they did to Stephen was usually how they got rid of people they didn't like. Now, maybe Stephen was low status enough that they could get away with this in front of the Roman officials. But they grab him, they take him outside of the city, and they stone him. And then Luke, the writer of the book of Acts, says, "And the witnesses laid down their garments at the feet of a young man named Saul." Now, this is not very many years after Jesus' death and resurrection. And here is Saul. And then when they were stoning Stephen, he looks up and cries out, "Lord, receive my spirit." And falling on his knees, he cried out in a loud voice, "Lord, do not hold this sin against them." And when he had said this, he fell asleep, meaning that he died. Now, one of the interesting things about Stephen in the book of Acts is that if you compare what Luke says about Jesus to what Luke says about Stephen, Stephen is the most Christ-like person in the book of Acts. And it's pretty amazing. And so here, Stephen's representation is an astounding thing given Luke's closeness to Paul. Luke traveled with Paul. Luke could have been a disciple of Paul's. And we would imagine that Luke, well, who puts Paul in a pretty favorable light through most of the book, does not shrink back from this chapter, but places Paul here, in a sense, at the head of a ring of conspirators against the Jesus followers, stoning the most Christ-like of them in the story, named Stephen. Conspiracies? Yeah, conspiracies exist. But changes through time by contextualized decisions. This is how we live. There's an end state we want to get to, but the way there is not clear. Stephen, a diaspora Jew living in Jerusalem, becomes a deacon who becomes a powerful leader and preacher. And Saul, also a diaspora Jew, a Pharisee, learned, educated, high-status leader, zealous for the Lord, as N.T. Wright notes in his biography and as Paul writes about himself, is responsible for Stephen's death and the arrest and imprisonment and death of others at one point in time. So what's the truth? We've been looking at Peter. Peter is a fisherman or a tradesman looking for the restoration of Israel. That comes in Acts chapter 1. Jesus calls him rock, and Jesus calls him Satan. So what's the truth about Peter? He's the apostle to the Jews because he shrunk back from the table with the Gentiles, and Paul upbraids him, and then that gets recorded in the book of Galatians. But Peter eventually becomes the bishop of Rome, full of Gentile Christians, of course. So how do you believe? How do you know what to think when there's so much information out there and there's so much conflict about who can be trusted and who can't be trusted? Is Tony Fauci in the pocket of the vaccine makers, or is Tony Fauci the gold standard of a scientist giving us the truth, no matter the political consequence? And then there's all these transformations that happen in time. Stephen gets changed from a good diaspora Jewish lad into this bold follower of Jesus and loses his life for it. Paul has somewhat the same journey, but at a different time. He's responsible for Stephen's death, and then Paul will lose his life for it. Stephen adopts new beliefs about Jesus, joins the Christian herd, and dies for them. Saul resists the new herd, is rewarded by the old herd, but then switches herds, which never makes anyone in the old herd happy. And you know how people feel about traitors. And then Ananias of Damascus, God comes to him in a dream and says, you've got to go to Saul and pray for him that he'll receive his sight. And Ananias says, whoa, I know who this guy is. You want me to go, you want to heal him? And the Lord says to him, I'll show you how much he must suffer for my name. And Paul does suffer, but he doesn't turn back. Peter, likely the oldest of the bunch, a middle-class tradesman who knows risk, religiously and politically earnest about Israel's redemption from imperial bondage, was a disciple of John the Baptist, elevated to a status of rock, but still can't understand Jesus, and so is called Satan, denies Jesus three times, the empty tomb, the Holy Spirit, dietary laws, still not quite sure what to do with the Gentiles, leads the church in the imperial city, and will be killed by the emperor. How do you manage what to know and how to live? Well, here in the beginning of the second chapter, we've got three Old Testament quotations and some exhortation. Therefore, ridding yourselves of all malice and all deceit and hypocrisy and envy and all slander, all of these things inside of ourselves that we know are not true. Again, the world is too big to know on the outside, so we start on the inside. So malice, deceit, hypocrisy, slander, getting rid of the lie on the inside, like newborn infants, because remember, we're born again by the resurrection, longing for unadulterated spiritual milk so that you may grow up into salvation. Salvation of what? Salvation of everything. If you have tasted that the Lord is kind, to whom you are drawing near, a living stone, rejected by men and chosen and precious in the sight of God. We talked about that a bit last week. And you yourselves as living stones, our connection with him. Remember, we see our future self in the resurrected Jesus. So he is the model stone. We are the substones. He is the pattern. We are the patterned. As being built as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Now notice the holy priesthood temple imagery at the beginning of this section and at the end of this section. And in the middle is these conflicted contests of people not knowing what the truth is and others having to wage. Behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a precious cornerstone, and the one who believes in him will not be put to shame. In other words, he's the one to follow. Therefore, the honor is for you who believe, for you who trust. Those are the ones who are not put to shame. The honor is for you who believe, but for those who refuse to believe, for those who pick the wrong herd, the stone the builders rejected, this one has become the cornerstone. Now, it's often said to me things like, well, nobody knows. Well, that's not usually true. And I think about the downturn in 2008. Well, nobody knows that the housing market will burst. No, some people knew and they bet on it and they were rewarded greatly. Others maybe were willfully blind. Same thing with the pandemic. Well, nobody, who could have known this would happen? No, people have been saying it for a long time that it is going to happen. Now here it is. Well, nobody knew. Well, no, that's not really true. We all just in our lifetimes have to choose, and we take all of those reasons and boil them down, and usually what we do is we find the person to trust, and we follow them. A stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. The hero of some is the offensive person of the other. Don't you notice that in conspiracy theory dynamics? A stone of stumbling and a rock of offense who stumble because they began to disobey the word to which they were consigned. So in other words, there's two things going on. On one hand, the world is too big. We can't know everything. So the way we monitor that is we find someone we trust and we follow them. Well, what do you have to do inside? Inside, you have to rid yourself of malice and deceit and hypocrisy and slander so that you can know who to follow. Now, more herd language. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people of God's possession, so that you may proclaim the virtue of the one who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. You once were not a people, you were not a herd, you were stragglers, but now you are a people of God. The ones who were not shown mercy, but now have shown mercy. Now this is going to get complicated because sheep herd up in order to succeed. We cooperate in order to compete. And so on one hand, the herd grows when others look at who's getting eaten and saying, that herd there is flourishing. But they're a herd of sheep. How broad have my menus really been? See, no one chooses the time or the place of their birth, their parents, the culture, their DNA, their upbringing, or your herd. You're usually born into a herd. We are thrown into the maelstrom of history with near infinite competing perspectives, always limited by the necessary herding that's going on. And the Bible always frames our choosing within God's governance of everything, because you see, there's both God frames it, God put you in this herd, but now you still have to decide, do I stick to this herd? Do I go to another herd? But all of the choices you're making are all also still under what God is doing. It's very much both and. Yeah, your consequences are real and consequential. Looking at that stone. Now, what you'll see from Stephen, from Peter, from Paul, is that as we go through history, even these great heroes of the faith, it doesn't necessarily look like a straight line. When I was a kid and I would do, sometimes in church, those little maze puzzles, I very quickly figured out that the puzzles were easily doing starting at the exit and working back to the entrance rather than the other way around. That was a way of minimizing the combinatorial explosion of the maze. But as we're going through it, diachronistically, there's all these missteps. Peter follows John and then Jesus. Peter is both the rock and Satan. Judas and Peter both deny Jesus. Judas betrays him. Judas goes on into perdition and Peter is restored. Peter makes stumbling moves with respect to the Gentiles, but here is Peter now. That's a lot like us. One of the things, and I'm not going to get to chapter 4 and chapter 5, but you should read them on your own, and when you read them, you'll probably say, boy, that's really repetitive. This is all the stuff Paul was talking about in chapter 1 and chapter 2. He keeps coming back to the point of the evil desires and the sobriety and the dissipation and that relationship with the gospel. And it leads a lot of people to imagine, oh, the gospel is doing all these things inside to stay clean so that I can be rewarded. Well, you should do all those things inside to stay clean so that you can be rewarded, but that's not the biggest frame. You see, Peter keeps admonishing the Christians to do this. Why is Peter so repetitive? Well, you've never heard me preach a sermon at Living Stones. Y'all got to stop knifing each other in the middle of the service. You know, I'm just up here preaching and, you know, Maury pulls out a knife and stabs Nina. Or Nina pulls out a knife and stabs Carmen. I never preached that. Why? Because it never happened. And I don't expect it to ever happen. So you never hear me preach it. So why does Peter keep harping on about this to the people in the church? Because they're just like Peter. And they're just like me. And they're just like you. That we keep stumbling over these things. So, in other words, the herd of sheep isn't there yet. They got to stay in a herd, because if they don't, their epithumias would put them all over the map. Now, one of the interesting things that John Vervaeke, and he actually made a really good video a good interview about the COVID epidemic and conspiracy theories, it says, you know, the world is too big. It's hard to just pick the outcomes out there. What you have to do is focus on the process. And that's exactly what Peter is doing with respect to the epithumias and these desires that are distracting the sheep and sending them all over the map and breaking up the herd. See, you can't know the truth by knowing everything, because the world is just too big and we are small-brained, short-lived creatures. And this is why human beings believe in herds, and why they herd up, and why they trust models and leaders. So you focus on the process of knowing, and you try to address all the error detection, the ways that we BS ourselves, and the ways that we deceive ourselves. That's exactly what Peter is talking about with all these moral, put away these things. You're distracting yourself. You're making yourself weak. You're lying to yourself. You've got to stop all that stuff. Why? But what's the end? Is the end just stopping that stuff? No, it's in pursuit of something else. You see, what all conspiracy theories tend to have in common is that someone wants something at the expense of someone else. And Peter is always warning about these desires that we fall prey to. Money, power, control, ego, all the usual suspects. And then he says, look at the living stone. Trust in the living stone. Herd up around the living stones so that you go from sheep, living stoners, to become living stones. How do we know who to trust? We know who to trust because of the one who loved us. Well, how do we know who loves us? Because most kings let people die so that the king will live. And Jesus is the only king. Pilate said it himself. Three languages. Jesus is the only king that dies on behalf of his people. Or he's the paradigmatic king who dies on behalf of his people. Freely, sacrificially, for the welfare of even his enemies. Stephen did this because he was following Jesus. This is how we orient ourselves to the truth. We become little living stones, like the model, that others may learn the same orientation and see the truest big picture. Now we remain situated in time, in our little fallen limited herds, and we fall victim to ourselves, the epithumias, and we fall victim to the sins and limitations of our herd, the bad ideas, the conspiracy theories, the sinful things that we group up on, and the things that we do together, which are more evil than we could even individually do. And we will be caught holding the cloaks for evil. But for Paul, the process of error correction became the New Testament. And if you want to know why he wrote all those letters, it was all that error correction that he was doing. This is the new perspective on his old life. And all of the gifts that he had before Jesus met him on the road to Damascus were put to use, even that moment when he killed Stephen. This is how God works. Now, our decision making is within the realm of the Good Shepherd, but we remain sheep. We will get lots of things wrong. Our menu options are limited. But our trust is finally placed in his lordship and not in our capacity to rescue ourselves. The living stone. We become smaller, less perfect, less important role players in the drama than he is, for sure. but necessary and part of the great temple nevertheless. We exhort each other, even in the midst of the confusion and the heard disagreement, to limit the BSing ourselves, to keep our eyes on that living stone, to be like him when we're located in different times and different places within the great temple of his sovereign and ruling rest.